This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Wesleyan University in Middletown has partnered with the university in Kiev, Ukraine, to focus on the issues of environment and civic activism. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wesleyan professor and a student just back from a trip to Ukraine that included a visit to Chernobyl. We'll also hear what they learned from activists who were involved in the country's revolution back in 2014. That's later. First, the movie Little Pink House premiered this weekend in movie theaters around the country. It focuses on a Connecticut story that became national news when New London resident Suzette Kilo and several others fought the city in an eminent domain case. Ironically, that parcel of land in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood sits vacant today, years after a U.S. Supreme Court decision sided with New London, permitting the sale of private land to private developers. Now, why has the story captured Hollywood's attention now? Largely because of the book Little Pink House, a true story of defiance and courage. The screenplay was adapted from the book by the same name, and author Jeff Benedict joins us from a studio now at KUER in Salt Lake City. Jeff again is author of Little Pink House, executive producer of the film adaptation. His most recent book is a New York Times bestselling biography of Tiger Woods. Jeff, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you are originally from Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about what you remember going on near the end of the 90s, early 2000s in New London. What was the economic situation like back then?
It was tough. I mean, New London was and has been economically depressed. And I was actually not only from there, I was living there at the time. And just two towns over in East Lyme, and I was watching this thing play out the way most people were in the newspapers. And then in 2001, when I was a candidate for Congress, and in 2002, I was getting asked about it a lot. And I didn't know enough about it to talk in an informed way, but basically it got to a point once the U.S. Supreme Court took the case that that's when I really got engaged as a journalist and decided to go down to Fort Trumbull and to start writing the book.
For those listeners who are unfamiliar with Fort Trumbull, describe that neighborhood and walk us through a little bit of the beginnings of this story.
The neighborhood it's actually a really interesting neighborhood because there's a lot of different things in that neighborhood. It's right next to Fort Trumbull, an actual historical fort, which today is a state park that you can go to. But it's right on the Thames River, and there were a lot of homes, and there was a deli there. There were some mixed use development there, but basically there was a tight knit community of people who'd lived. Most of the people who lived in Fort Trumbull in the 90s had been there forever. There were literally families that had never lived in any other house. There were senior citizens who had been born in the homes they were living in at that time. And so there was this closeness. It was a neighborhood of immigrants for the most part. Suzette Kilo was actually one of the newer residents in the neighborhood. She'd barely moved in when all this stuff started, but her neighbors were people that had deep roots there.
Let's talk a little bit about eminent domain. Before this Kilo case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, how were municipalities around the country able to use this particular way of seizing property? And what were some of the questions surrounding it?
Well, Connecticut was actually unique in the sense that the eminent domain law in Connecticut was a little different than it is in most other states. Typically, eminent domain can only be used when a state or a municipality takes private land for public use. And on its face, that's a pretty simple concept. So if you own a house and it happens to be on a parcel where the state intends to build a public building or a school or an airport, that land can be taken by eminent domain and you would be compensated for its fair market value. In the case of New London, that's not what was happening. This was private land that was being taken by a private corporation, the New London Development Corporation, and it was going to be turned over to a developer, not for public use, but for private development. The justification for it under the law was that Connecticut permits a municipality to do that if you're also going to produce public benefits. And that's a more liberal interpretation of the eminent domain law. In other words, if this private development was going to produce benefits for the public, such as creating jobs, generating tax revenue, it would be justifiable under Connecticut law. So in a really technical sense, New London wasn't breaking the law when it did what it did.
So you had a lot of parties involved in this situation, Pfizer being mentioned, also this New London Development Corporation, also Republican Governor John Rowland and the city of New London. The New London Development Corporation originally offered to buy out residents in Fort Trumbull or to give them fair market value for their property, but Suzette Kilo and others refused. Walk us through, you know, what were some of their, I mean, nobody wants to lose their house, but they had some issues with this idea of land being taken to then be possibly for luxury condos and the ability for Pfizer to build an expansion headquarters?
The birth of this idea actually is really important to understanding the outcome of what happened here. This all started when Governor Rowland and Peter Eliff came up with an idea to do some waterfront redevelopment in New London. And they hired Jay Levin as a consultant. Jay Levin was a former mayor of New London, very well-connected presence in the Democratic Party. He got hired as a consultant, which was a strategically a really wise move on Governor Rowland's part. And it was Jay Levin, as he looked at the waterfront and the landscape, and frankly, what Governor Rowland was trying to do was would have been a good thing for New London. And I think what Jay Levin was attempting to do was also would have been a good thing. But at one point, there was a decision made to hire Claire Gaudiani, who was then the president of Connecticut College. And they were going to put her in charge of the New London Development Corporation, which was something that had been established in the late 70s to do development in New London, but had been dormant for years. And here's where things start to get dicey. They reinvigorate the NLDC. They empower Claire to be its president. She puts a board together, a board of directors, and she puts George Milne, who was then the president of Pfizer, on that board. And here is hatched this idea of trying to lure Pfizer into New London. The city had a parcel of land next to Fort Trumbull that it had been in possession of for quite some time. It had never been able to develop it because the land was polluted, badly polluted. It used to be a linoleum factory. They convinced Pfizer to take over that property and build a research and development facility there because they basically offered them the land for nothing. The state of Connecticut guaranteed the cleanup. They removed any liability from that cleanup from Pfizer, and they offered them 10 years of tax abatements and a truckload of money to go along with Pfizer spending their own money to build their building. But one of the problems with the plan was Pfizer needed more space, and Pfizer wasn't excited about being next door to Fort Trumbull. And so the New London Development Corporation took it upon itself to try to clear that land and redevelop it with things that would be more consistent with what Pfizer needed and wanted, a five-star hotel, business space that would have been more consistent with the kinds of things that Pfizer was doing, new upscale housing for residents, et cetera. And initially, they went into the neighborhood and tried to buy out homeowners, and some people did take the buyout. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people didn't want to take the buyout. They didn't want to move out of their neighborhood, particularly the senior citizens and the elderly people who'd been there forever. And I think it was the decision at that point to exercise the right to use eminent domain. They had the right to use it. The question all along was, should they exercise that right? And I think, you know, in hindsight, it's clear to see that was a mistake.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking to author Jeff Benedict. The screenplay for the movie Little Pink House was adapted from his book of the same name. It tells the story of Suzette Kilo, a Connecticut resident, and others who fought to save their homes in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood from the city of New London and its use of eminent domain for a redevelopment plan. Jeff, Connecticut Public Radio spoke to Suzette Kilo over the weekend. Here's what she told Harriet Jones.
I think it was painful for everybody. I mean, my two grown sons went, and they were like, what, are you kidding me? You know, like, so, I mean, I think it was painful for people to realize You know that, you know, you go to work every day, you pay your bills, you're a taxpayer, you're a law-abiding citizen, you keep your yard clean, grow your vegetables in your little garden, raise your family. And to have this happen to people that were just trying to be simple people and live their lives is really wrong.
There's Suzette Kilos talking about what it was like to see her story on the big screen again, in large part because of the book that you wrote, Jeff. So how did you meet Suzette Kilo?
That's a great story. So I was living in Niantic at the time, and which is about an 8-minute drive from where I lived to her neighborhood. And right after the Supreme Court made its announcement or its ruling 5-4 in favor of the city, which was really the last stop on the tracks, meaning there were no courses of appeal after that, it was clear that the remaining holdouts were going to have to vacate and get out. And I drove into Fort Trumbull, and I made a cold call. I pulled up to Suzette's house. And I have to tell you, and this is not an exaggeration, when I drove into that neighborhood right after the Supreme Court decision, it did look like a war zone down there. And I'm not trying to be dramatic, but there were houses that had literally been reduced to rubble. There were piles of brick and stone and construction material all over the neighborhood. And then dotted around that were homes that were still standing. There were 7 of them, as I recall at the time, hers being one of them. Here was this beautifully well-kept home that was surrounded by houses that looked like they'd been blown up. I mean, it was this surreal atmosphere. And I went up to her door, the pink house, I knocked on it, she answered. And I said, hello, my name is Jeff Benedict and I'm a writer. And she said, I know who you are. And it was abrupt, and I wasn't sure if she was angry at me, you know, because we'd never met before. And then, so I took a step back, and then she said, what took you so long? And I wasn't sure what that even meant, but then she explained that she's a nurse at the time, and she said one of the physicians at the hospital where she worked, Bacchus Hospital in Norwich, had encouraged her 2 years earlier to reach out to me about writing that story, and she never did. And so she invited me in, and I spent 3 hours that first day sitting at her kitchen table, asking her questions, getting to know her. She actually made me a meal the first time I was there. She made me homemade soup on a stove. And it's amazing what you can learn about a person when you're sitting in their kitchen, looking them in the eye. And what I was seeing was this woman that I was talking to for the first time in my life was not the character that had been portrayed by her opponents in the press for the last 7 or 8 years during this very spirited legal fight. I saw someone who was pretty humble, pretty simple, and pretty injured. And I could tell that all of this was genuine. She really just wanted to live in that house. It was the first thing she'd ever owned in her life. She'd been through 2 divorces. She'd raised 5 sons. She was approaching midlife, and she finally had something to call her own, and she just didn't want to go.
Jeff, you mentioned press accounts at the time. You know, what was the perception? What was public opinion surrounding the fact that, again, the city of New London wanted to build on this property and these homes were going to be demolished? I mean, were people sympathetic to Suzette and the others?
Oh, completely. By this time, I mean, we're talking now, the fight has been going on for 8 years at that point. And I would say not only was local sentiment on their sides, the entire country was on their sides. By that point, this was in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, every network news station, you know, from Brian Williams to Dan Rather, everybody was covering this. And the sentiment was, you know, Democrats and Republicans alike were on her side, even in Washington. This was a decision that was so vilified that there were people threatening from Texas to California to Maine that were threatening to come to New London and surround her house and defend it so that she could stay there, despite what the court had said. So when I showed up there, it was the atmosphere there, I would compare it to a powder keg that someone just needed to light a match and it was going to blow up down there. That's how intense it was when I showed up.
You're listening to Jeff Benedict, author Jeff Benedict, on Where We Live today as we talk about the movie Little Pink House. It's based on his book, which centered on Suzette Kilo's fight with the city of New London when property in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood was taken by eminent domain to make way for a redevelopment project. Now, much of the land in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood is still vacant today. Do you live in New London? What do you want to see happen to that property? You can join the conversation 860-275-7266, email wherewelive@wmpr.org, and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. After the break, more with Jeff Benedict. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Today we're talking about the movie Little Pink House, which tells the story of Connecticut resident Suzette Kilo and her fight against eminent domain by the city of New London. Here's a clip from the movie between Kilo, played by actress Catherine Keener, and a representative from the city's development corporation.
Wow, it looks really nice in here. Take it you've done quite the renovation on this place.
I have. I love it. Thank you. Have Great. A seat, please.
Thank you.
Sure.
So, the NLDC would like to make you an offer to buy your house.
Oh, but it's not for sale.
Well, we're offering you $68,000. That's significantly more than what you pay for it.
I don't want to sell it. Thank you.
Mrs. Kello, we're making you a...
It's Kilo.
Kilo, excuse me.
We are
making you a very generous offer on this house. I'm sure you're aware of the redevelopments.
No, not really.
Well, your property is in the area designated for the expansion effort.
Let me ask you something. Do you work for Pfizer?
No. New London Development Corporation.
But it's for Pfizer, ultimately, right?
Not exactly.
And who exactly is it for? Doesn't matter. Either way, I don't want to sell.
That's from the movie Little Pink House, which opened in theaters across the country. Now, Real Artways in Hartford will have the movie showing starting this Friday. You can get more information on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. The movie screenplay adapted from the book by author Jeff Benedict. It's a book of the same name, Little Pink House, about Suzette Kilo's fight against the city of New London and its use of eminent domain to take property for redevelopment. As we mentioned, the case eventually made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices ultimately decided in a 5-4 decision the city of New London could take private property and sell it to private developers. Author Jeff Benedict joins us today from the studio at KUER in Salt Lake City. Jeff, why did this project ultimately fail? Nearly 20 years later, that land is still vacant in New London.
Unfortunately, I think for everybody involved, that land has a scarlet letter on it. The entire city of New London took a major hit when this lawsuit played out the way that it did. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people have been hurt by this. And it's quite amazing, really, to go down there today. And I live in New London County right now. And so I'm in New London often. I was there with Suzette 2 days ago and, for dinner. And every time that I go into Fort Trumbull and look at what's not there, it's painful. You would think by now that wounds would heal and that there would be development there. But the fact is that the lawsuit made it, it got to the point where there was a developer. I mean, that's what a lot of people forget. There was a big time developer who was signed up and was spending money and was on the job in New London. There was financing provided by a lender. Everything was in place, but all of this came to a screeching halt with the litigation. And I think, again, hindsight being 2020, you look at the opportunities where compromises could have been made that would have enabled the development to go forward and these remaining residents to stay, and it's sad that didn't happen. And I think it's fair to say too that Governor Jody Rell, she's the one who inherited this mess when she became governor. Governor Rowland's legal problems happened in the middle of this litigation as well. And so Governor Rell took over and was the governor when the Supreme Court decision came down and then was faced with the question of what do you do now? The law has said they have to go. They're refusing to go. What are you going to do? Drag these people out of their house? Use law enforcement and while the country watches it on television news at night? And so all of those scars are attached to that parcel, those parcels down there. And I think it has a lot to do with why there's nothing there yet.
Suzette Kilo's house was eventually moved out of that neighborhood. It wasn't demolished, but she doesn't live there anymore, and neither do many of the others who were forced out. Why do you think this story is making it to the screen now, Jeff?
Well, it takes, first of all, it's rare that any book gets made into a movie. So we're very fortunate that Little Pink House got made into a film, but making movies takes a long time. And in my book, this actually happened kind of quickly. But the interest in the topic of eminent domain remains relevant today because it's still being used. Mm-hmm. We have a president right now who is a huge supporter of eminent domain, who's been an advocate for it in Atlantic City, where he had a casino industry. So I think that the topic of eminent domain remains on people's minds, particularly because so often it's used against the little guy. Mm-hmm. It's people that often don't have the power to stand up and defend themselves because they can't afford it when eminent domain is used to take people's land for development.
What happened? What was the reaction from states and municipalities around the country after that Supreme Court decision? It's been described as one of the most unpopular decisions in history when you look at public opinion. But what did we see happening in towns and states around the country when homeowners were thinking about this threat of their property maybe one day being seized by the government?
Well, it's interesting because almost every state in the union has modified and in some cases drastically renovated their eminent domain laws as a result of the Kilo case. In fact, I'm in Utah right now on a book tour, but last night I attended a panel discussion at the University of Utah's law school about eminent domain. And I was with other lawyers that practice eminent domain law, and they were talking about how the Kilo case dramatically changed Utah's laws, making it much harder to do what was done in New London. Ironically, Connecticut has not changed its law as a result of this case. It's one of the only states in the country that hasn't changed its eminent domain law to make it more difficult for this kind of thing to be repeated. So I think that's kind of interesting, and it's actually something that I think should be changed in Connecticut.
Individual towns, did they make changes to their laws if there's no overarching state law here in Connecticut?
Well, I mean, obviously every town can make its own decisions about how it wants to proceed. And I think one lesson that a lot of municipalities learned is that this is not the way to do redevelopment. In other words, at the end of the day, we're talking about people's lives. I mean, these are human beings who are your neighbors. And these are people you got to pass in a grocery store. Whose kids go to your schools. And so if you want a community to really function, there's a better way to do this. Eminent domain is a blunt instrument. And now look, when you're building a dam or an airport or a train station, it has its use. It sometimes has to be used. But a lot of times when you're doing urban renewal, there are better ways to work with a community to make people be part of that process and to recognize that we're ultimately dealing with human beings. We're dealing with one of the most precious things to a person in this country is your property, your home. There's something sacrosanct about that. And I think the Constitution of the United States tried to recognize that, the founders did when they drafted the Fifth Amendment. And so I think that kind of approach needs to be taken when you're dealing with urban renewal.
Suzette Kilo was definitely the face of this fight, but so many others were also impacted. And again, now this land remains vacant. Pfizer has a much smaller footprint in the city of New London, more than two decades later. What do you think is going to happen to that parcel of land? I think I read somewhere that there's plans for a possible memorial.
Well, look, this has been an ongoing question, what do you think is going to happen or what might happen there? It's a question that's now been on the edge of people's tongues for more than a decade. And obviously, something does need to happen down there. And I think for the good of the city and for everybody else who's been impacted by this, it is time. I mean, and I've really felt that lately, especially now that the film is out and there's more focus on it again, that I actually think there's an opportunity here for something really good to happen. But I think it's going to take more than just talking about it, and it's going to take more than just hope. It's time, I think, for some impactful healing and bringing people together in a way that can produce something that, in the end, hopefully, will be good for the city of New London, but also good for the people who were injured in this. I do think there's a way to still rectify things. And in some ways, it's not just saying I'm sorry, but I think that there's a point where if you really want to make this right, there's an opportunity here to work with people who were kicked out.
Jeff Benedict is author of Little Pink House and executive producer of the film adaptation that's showing at theaters around the country, including this Friday it begins an open-ended run at Real Art Ways in Hartford. More information on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Jeff Benedict, also author of one of his latest books, all about Tiger Woods. He joined us today from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Jeff, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Where We Live comes to you on Connecticut Public Radio because of listener support. It's our spring membership campaign. You can continue to support Where We Live and all the great programming on this radio station. We're going to come back after the break with a segment on a unique partnership between Wesleyan University and a university in Ukraine. But if these are the kinds of conversations in your backyard, the stories that resonate, that happen here nationally, we want you to support this station. And you can do that with two of my colleagues who can tell you more. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Thursday, guilt. We've all felt it, that stomach-turning sensation we often associate with our parents. But could a little guilt be healthy for us? On the next Where We Live, we'll consider that question and more. And we want to hear from you, too. When was the last time you felt guilty? And how did that emotion impact you? You can join the conversation on Thursday. Now we're turning our attention to an initiative between Wesleyan University in Middletown and a university in Kiev, Ukraine. For more about this unique partnership, joining me now in studio is Katia Kolsio, professor of environmental studies and dance at Wesleyan, also a member of the Ukrainian-American community here in Connecticut. Katia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you recently led a trip of students to Ukraine. I believe it was last month, part of a series of programs at Wesleyan's College of the Environment. Why this focus on Ukraine specifically?
Yeah, it's extremely exciting. The course itself is part of a larger initiative in which we're partnering with a counterpart university in Kyiv, Taras Shevchenko University. And the fact is, this is not just about Ukraine. It's about a much bigger issue, and that is the world is changing at an alarming rate in wonderful ways. It's getting smaller. It's shrinking. But political and economic interdependence is increasing. Communication and information flow is increasing. Changes in the environment are causing us to have to rethink issues of basic survival, even here in the United States. And this can be overwhelming. So the College of the Environment at Wesleyan University, which was founded and directed by Dr. Barry Chernoff, who's himself a fish biologist, had this interdisciplinary vision of addressing these problems through research-based but very hands-on and action-oriented approach, also with the premise that the environment can't be addressed alone. We can't solve our problems through a one-nation approach. So what happened in regard to Ukraine is, I think, one of those miraculous happenings. It's just magical that these things happened at the same time. The revolution of dignity that took place in the winter of 2013 and 14 was a truly broad-based and popular revolution. It was not unlike the civil rights movement in the United States, except perhaps it included a larger segment of the population, embraced by all of Ukraine's ethnic groups, religious denominations. It was marked by Ukrainians rejecting right-wing extremism and politics of division. in favor of progressive democratic values and civic mobilization. So along with this came a surge in civic engagement, of which we took note right away.
So when you led this group of students from Wesleyan, how did you tie in that civic engagement that's happening within the country? Because so often, as you know, the headlines when we think of Ukraine is its relationship with Russia, the annexation of Crimea. But you're looking at what's happening within the country, the civic engagement that continues since that revolution.
Exactly. The civic engagement and the tremendous strides made in legislative reforms by civic activists and non-government parties. So it's in a sense an experiment, and we're aware that the issues of the environment in Ukraine are very much also part of a political dimension and significant from a geopolitical standpoint. The rich resources in Ukraine, its situation between the East and West, which make it politically sensitive region. And the fact that it's undergoing somewhat of a social experiment, which and that we don't hear about in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So this inundation of information also has the sad effect of making it impossible to know everything. And the way we're countering that is by bringing students to Ukraine, bringing movers and shakers from Ukraine to the U.S. to bring some attention to the massive social reforms and this optimistic movement towards some kind of a sustainable future. And when I say sustainable, the College of the Environment at Wesleyan understands environmental issues from a broad perspective that includes, natural resources, natural environment, social environment, and how those all play together. So for our students, this was a chance to go to a place where, despite the fact that there's a war, that there's been an invasion, that there are multiple players who have specific interests in Ukraine, what's happening on the ground is this inspiring mobilization of people, and that we can do that in the U.S. as well. And in fact, we can't really address the very, very real and tangible problems we're facing on a global level unless we do it together, crossing national boundaries.
Yeah. Katia Colcio is, again, a professor of environmental studies and dance at Wesleyan. She led a group of Wesleyan students to Ukraine last month. One of those students is on the phone right now, Anna Fox. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We heard Katia mention being able to witness this civic engagement, this movement, environmental movement, that I believe is fairly new for Ukraine. What did you learn when you went there?
When we had the opportunity to visit Kyiv, we were able both to go to offices of different environmental movements, both national ones and local ones, but also sort of engage with students as people and folks who are working towards environmental sustainability, not necessarily in sustainable formal movements, rather. But one of the things that was really striking was, as Katia said earlier, sort of the energy that came out of the Revolution of Dignity in 2014. A lot of the language around environmental sustainability was definitely tied in with political sustainability and was very aware of the geopolitics, but it was also very hopeful. It was very much like we've created this revolution, we have this energy, and we are actively using this energy that we had from this national movement to make Ukraine a better place, to make the world a better place, to work collectively to do that. People would point to different elements of the Revolution of Dignity. The fact that there was an accessible library, and that was a huge part, a huge communal element of it. People would point to those sort of as models for longer-term environmentally sustainable movements.
And
which is really striking.
Anna, you were meeting with new leaders in Ukraine, many of them who were much older than you. What was that like to have a discussion with them about their process being involved politically?
Well, in large part, that was really empowering and really inspiring to see young people taking ownership of the things that matter to them and create these successful unifying movements. We spoke with folks that had created a language camp for folks in Ukraine to learn English, for folks who don't speak Ukrainian to learn Ukrainian. These communal spaces where folks get to know each other and where people from different communities can engage openly and honestly and compassionately. That was really cool. And the fact that they were so young, I think, brought this energy to our trip, where a lot of us on the trip really felt like this was something that we could be a part of and that we could learn from and that we could grow from and bring back to the States.
You also visited Chernobyl. What was that like to visit that site, one of the worst nuclear power disasters in history? And how does that, I guess, move the conversation forward with when we talk about this new environmental movement happening there, Anna?
Yeah, the Chernobyl nuclear disaster is still something that, not as much for my generation, of course, but a lot of people remember that as being a really horrific accident. And when I spoke to a lot of people, both in the States and in Ukraine, they were like, oh my God, you're actually going? It was a really intense experience, not just thinking about the explosion itself, but the way that at that time the Soviet government reacted to it, the way that especially people were asked to leave their homes and the towns that they'd been living in for generations. One thing that was really moving is hearing the stories of the people that went back to their homes, knowing that there was a lot of radiation, and sort of saying, like, well, if I'm going to die either way, I would rather die on my land, on my parents' land, on my grandparents' land, in the place that's been a home to me for so long. There was one abandoned home we had the opportunity to walk into, and the former resident had left and then returned, and she had built a stove to keep herself warm. And the story about this woman is that she had built stoves for everyone who had come back to their homes inside the exclusion zone. And that was really moving.
We're hearing about a recent trip to Ukraine by Wesleyan student Anna Fox, led by Katia Kolsio, a professor of environmental studies and dance at Wesleyan. As we listen about just the impression that visiting Chernobyl had on Anna and others, you know, when people are talking about alternative sources for energy, when they look at Chernobyl, is that still on their minds? Katia.
Yeah, and in very interesting ways. I think an important point is that it's fairly well accepted that the environmental movement in 1986 following the disaster in Chernobyl was a catalyst for the breakup of the Soviet Union. It had a tremendous impact on the people, but specifically in regard to their recognition of the failure of the government to inform its citizens, to act transparently, to keep the safety of the citizens as a priority. And therefore, what is not happening is a huge anti-nuclear movement. So nuclear is part of this complex matrix of how Ukraine understands its energy future. Interestingly, we were in the context of environmental studies program, but we heard a lot of people saying energy independence is independence. Energy freedom is freedom. And the general sense is the future lies in renewable energy, and we have to move towards that. In the meantime, they're still bound to over 50% dependence on their nuclear power plants. They have active nuclear power plants. But just yesterday, I read in the newspaper that the nuclear plant in Zaporizhia, which is near the eastern border, not in the conflict zone, but near the eastern border, is building a giant solar power component to its station. So there's this concern and very nuanced understanding of how energy relates to freedom, to sustainability, and where citizen action, independent human mobilization plays a role in developing renewable resources for the long term.
Katia, we just have a couple of minutes, but I'm curious what questions they had for you, this American delegation that came over about the movement here with energy independence.
Oh, what questions what Ukrainians had
for you? Yes.
Oh, that's it. I wonder if Anna might be better at answering that question.
Anna, what kind of questions did the young people have for you?
There were lots of questions about how Ukraine was perceived by the West, and specifically by our peers at home. Lots of questions also about how Russia and how Putin were perceived. Obviously, we had very wide-ranging answers on that. But folks generally tended to ask, whether we thought it was safe to come to Kiev, whether we were scared. There's a lot of, I think, concern about the fact that Ukraine doesn't always get represented in the best light and doesn't really get a fair representation necessarily. You don't hear a lot about the really exciting activist work that's happening. So we had a lot of conversations about that. We also spoke a lot about how we approached learning about the environment in a broad-based, interdisciplinary way, the way the College of the Environment integrates all sorts of socially sustainable ideas, thinking about politically sustainable ideas, in addition to all of the different, you know, like hard environmental work that the College of the Environment does. That is a really different approach than a lot of other environmental or geopolitical programs take. And so that was a really interesting thing to consider in light of what we were learning in Ukraine.
And Katya, what's next for this partnership?
A lot, I hope. You know, the key is in developing sustainable and long-term relationships, which we hope to do around the world. But Ukraine is key player in at this time with the College of the Environment. We're continuing the program, this course, as part of our undergraduate program. We're also looking for longer substantive program initiatives that I can't speak to quite yet between our university and Taras Shevchenko Institute for International Relations.
So more to come. We'd love to have you back to talk more about that. Katya Kosio, Professor of Environmental Studies and Dance at Wesleyan University, and Anna Fox, a student at Wesleyan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. If you appreciate the programming here on WNPR, Connecticut Public Radio, here are two of my colleagues to tell you how you can support us during our spring membership campaign. And as always, thanks for listening.